the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Why are liberal mainline Protestant denominations losing members by the millions? That's not a new question, because this pattern of membership hemorrhage in these liberal churches has been around since at least the early 1960s. Today, we're going to be talking about why this is so and why it matters. We're going to be looking at some of those recent events in the news of these denominations, and they've been garnering headlines over the last several weeks. And we're going to talk about what this matters, why this matters, and what this means. Because when you start looking at these denominations, you realize they are the old established brand names of Christianity in America. You're talking about Lutheranism, Presbyterianism, Episcopalianism. We're going to be talking about what has happened to these churches, because it gets to the fundamental issues faced by every single denomination and every single church and every single congregation. I'm going to have as my special guest Dr. Greg Wills, one of my favorite church historians. He's going to be here to talk about this with us, not only in an historical context, but talking about what it means for us today. Just a couple of days ago, I talked about an article that had to do with a man that didn't get tenure at a North Carolina university. This particular man had complained that it was because he is a Christian. The Chronicle of Higher Education, which is like the Wall Street Journal of academia, ran a big article suggesting that there might be something to his claim, but there would be two sides to the story. And you might remember while we talked about this just a couple of days ago, I zeroed in on a statement made by Columbia University professor Randall Balmer, a church historian himself. And he said this, and the story introduces him by saying, of course, not all Christian professors are politically conservative. The point of the article at this stage is that opposition to Christian professors might have more to do with their conservatism in terms of political and moral issues than about their Christian commitment. This is how the article reads. Of course, not all Christian professors are politically conservative. Randall Balmer, a professor of American religious history at Barnard College, that's part of Columbia University, is an ordained Episcopal minister and a self-described evangelical. He is also a liberal. He published an article in the Chronicle Review last year titled "Jesus is Not a Republican." He has certainly heard people say that Christian professors are discriminated against, but he has never, in his 22 years of teaching at several universities, seen evidence of that. Quote, "The picture that has been painted on the right is that the academy is hostile to faith and a bastion of secularism. I simply haven't encountered that hostility." It goes on, he does believe that there is a liberal bias in academia. Quote, "And thank God for that," he says. "I'm glad there is a bunker against the tide of conservatism that has overtaken every other corner of our country." An amazingly candid statement. But just hold that. You've heard that before as you've been listening to this program. Let me go on and say that Paul Johnson, the British historian, has just published a very interesting article on more or less the same theme as published in the current issue of Forbes magazine. This is what he has to say. "My old university, Oxford, which was founded by monks, friars, and theologians 9 centuries ago, was until recently regarded as a bastion of old-fashioned Christianity, and as such was called the House of Lost Causes. Today, a publicly expressed belief in Christianity is likely to lower your chance of landing a job at Oxford. Religion has become a handicap in university life, especially in certain subjects. In philosophy, for example, academics who hope for senior chairs keep mum about any faith they hold. God and promotion do not mix. And in all the sciences, young men and women with religious backgrounds are advised to jettison their Christian, Jewish, or other religious baggage if they want to pursue careers in physics, chemistry, or biology. The universal assumption seems to be that a belief in God fatally debars a scholar from acquiring scientific knowledge. In Britain, the number of students concentrating in the sciences is on the decline, and the systematic discouragement of Christians and Jews in the science faculties will clearly increase that trend." Okay, here's my reading. You put those two articles side by side, here's my theory. My theory is this. If you identify yourself as a Christian, but your worldview largely conforms to that of the secular academy, you're going to do just fine. But if you identify as a Christian and your worldview is at odds with the secular academy, you're going to be in trouble. And this gets to the fact that is acknowledged by the reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education when an issue does come up, say abortion or same-sex marriage or homosexuality. If a Christian stands up and says, "I believe this because of my Christianity," you can bet that professor is likely to be in trouble. I had a professor at a major university, a very elite university, tell me of a conversation he had with a colleague, a Jewish colleague. In this case, the issue of the exclusivity of the gospel came up because of a news item, and his colleague said, "Do you really believe that people who don't believe in Jesus are going to hell?" The professor said, "Yes." And his colleague said, "Had I known that, I never would have voted for tenure for you. I don't want to work with a colleague who holds that kind of repulsive theology." So that's the deal. I think if you identify as a Christian and all you do is identify as a Christian and your worldview basically comports with that of the secular academy, then I think you'll probably just be just fine. But if your Christian worldview is seriously based in Scripture and is bold enough to confront the secular worldview in terms of its shortcomings and errors, then I think you're likely to be in big trouble. Big event just this week, last night, the University of Alabama in Birmingham was a debate between atheist Richard Dawkins and apologist, in this case, on the Christian side, John Lennox. John Lennox is also a scientist. He holds triple doctorates. It was a fascinating debate. We're going to hear just a little bit of it, and we'll be listening to more of this later. But I want you to hear what Richard Dawkins has to say about why religion is disappearing, why faith in God is evaporating.
I think that religious explanations, although they may have been satisfying for many centuries, are now superseded and outdated. I think, moreover, that they're petty and parochial, and that the understanding that we can get from science of all those deep questions that religion once aspired to explain are now better, more grandly, more in a more beautiful and elegant fashion explained by science.
The amazing thing there is not so much that he rejects belief in God, but that he has such an incredible faith in science to deliver answers to the ultimate questions of life. I would love to have been debating him then and then to ask him for science to give an explanation for some for our appreciation of beauty, for why a mother loves a child, for altruism. Science can't really answer any of those things. He went on. I want you to listen to what he has to say. This is one of his typical quips here.
Religion stultifies the impulse to understand, because religion provides a facile, easy, apparent explanation, although, as we'll see later in the evening, it isn't really an explanation, and it prevents the further work on the problem.
You know, the interesting thing there is that the more Richard Dawkins writes and talks, the more you discover he really doesn't know much about religion in general or Christianity in particular. And so you have to wonder which is more stultifying, science or what he calls religion. John Lennox, I think, was able to get in some very good points in this debate last night at the University of Alabama in Birmingham. There at the Alice Stevens Center, big event with a big crowd. Listen to what he has to say about, well, Christianity in the mind.
In the book, The God Delusion, Richard, you say that religion teaches us that it is a virtue to be satisfied with not understanding. Well, whatever other religion this may apply to, it certainly did not apply to the Christianity my parents taught me from the Bible. They encouraged me to be intellectually inquisitive because they were like that themselves. Not in spite of their Christian faith, but because of it. And I owe them an immense debt for setting me free to read everything from Marx and Russell to C.S. Lewis. I can't speak authoritatively for other religions, but faith in the Christian sense is not blind. And indeed, I do not know a serious Christian who thinks it is. Indeed, as I read it, blind faith in idols and figments of the human imagination, in other words, delusional gods, is roundly condemned in the Bible. My faith in God and Christ, as the Son of God, is no delusion. It is rational and evidence-based. Part of the evidence is objective, some of it comes from science, some comes from history, and some is subjective, coming from experience.
It's just a hint about the conversation that went on last night. I don't know if any minds were changed, but hopefully some minds were stimulated to further thought on the question. And this is another reminder to us that Christians have nothing to fear from this kind of debate. We have everything to gain. Because, after all, the more people think about these things, the more they will have to be drawn to the obvious weaknesses of the atheist position. And even as their hearts may incline them in that direction, if we can just make them unsettled a bit in their confidence in this, it just might be a sign that they will come closer to faith in Christ. This is the 50th anniversary today of Sputnik. 50 years ago today, the Soviet Union rocketed the first satellite to orbit the Earth. It, in many ways, changed the world. Literally, it was a part of the Cold War, of course, led to the space race that eventually put a man on the moon wearing an American spacesuit. But nonetheless, it is a reminder to us of how dependent we are on this technology, how we take it for granted, and fairly how recently in human history it seemed absolutely amazing that man could put an object in the sky that would orbit the Earth. Now, we're worried about them running into each other up there. Back to talk about why liberal denominations and churches are losing members by the millions. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation, coast to coast and with listeners around the world. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. The trend has now been in place for so long that it's taken as one of the principles of contemporary American church life. Liberal denominations, and they were called, back at the mid-20th century, they were called mainline Protestantism. And it's because even as there were mainline automobile makers, you had American Motors, General Motors, and the Ford Motor Corporation, the big three, you also had the big sisters of the mainline Protestant world. You had the Presbyterian Church, the United Methodist Church. You had the Disciples of Christ, the Congregationalists, the American Baptists, and the Episcopalians. And you start putting all that together, and you realize that that was the spinal backbone of Protestantism in America back in the 1950s. I guess the high watermark for that movement was the creation of the headquarters of the National Council of Churches there in Manhattan and Morningside Heights, the big building known now unaffectionately as the God Box. It's a big stone box. And it was making a major statement there in the establishment's capital, there in New York, that we are the establishment. But they're really not the establishment now, not by a long shot. The Wall Street Journal a few years ago ran an article with a headline, "The Episcopal Church Goes the Way of the Dodo." That's, by the way, pointing towards extinction. They are losing members by the millions. It was really noted by the 1960s. It was lamented by the 1970s, researched by the 1980s, and just taken as a fact of life by the 1990s. You take the Presbyterian Church USA, which is the merger of the Northern and Southern churches that took place in the 1980s, and you're looking at a church that's lost millions of members. The Episcopal Church U.S., the same thing. You start looking down denomination by denomination, they've been losing members. In the headlines recently, we see some of the reason why. When I mentioned them a few minutes ago, I left out the Lutherans. Now, the mainline Lutheran denomination is the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. That's the church we talked about that just a few weeks ago decided to keep its principle, its law, its regulation against openly homosexual ministers, but then it suggested that its own bishops ignore that and not bring any charges against anyone who's found to be violating the law of the church. A similar kind of institutionalized hypocrisy took place among the Presbyterians, where they said, we're going to keep our principle, we're just going to let local presbyteries violate it. And now you have the Episcopal Church USA and all of its travail over the issue of homosexuality. The big question is, however, why are they so determined to lose members? I mean, it's almost as if they have not only swallowed the poison pill of liberal theology, but they're so committed to it, they're committed to it right to the suicide of their own denominations. Just in recent days, the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church USA, Catherine Jeffords Shorey, spoke in San Francisco, and she had a lot to say. For one thing, just in the face of the Anglican Communion, she said her church is not reversing its pro-homosexual stances. Very defiant attitude. But the amazing thing is she also acknowledged that the church is losing members. And to summarize her argument, she said, yes, we're losing them, and I guess we're going to continue to lose them, but maybe there'll be some new people who will come in. My guest today is Dr. Greg Wills, a widely published church historian. He is professor of church history here at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, an expert on American church life. And I want to ask Dr. Wills this leading question right away. Dr. Wills, why in the world would these churches embrace a theology that is leading to their own destruction?
Well, first of all, let me just say I'm happy to be here. And the reason they're doing that, I believe, is that they lost all foundation for having a distinct message to give to human beings.
And when did that happen?
Well, it started as early as the 1870s. You have the famous David Swing trial in Chicago.
In what denomination? Tell the story.
In the Presbyterian Church. And he had given up his confidence in the integrity of the scriptures, and some of his conservative colleagues brought him to trial, and he pulled out of the denomination rather than suffer what ultimately he would have suffered in the 1870s, expulsion from the denomination, defrocking. That would not have happened just 20 or 30 years later, certainly would not happen today.
Just to take that one denomination, Presbyterianism, very early in the 20th century, you had the famous trial of Charles Augustus Briggs, professor at Union Theological Seminary. And if anyone in the 20th century represented liberal theology, it would be Charles Augustus Briggs. And what happened then?
Well, what happened to Union Theological Seminary in New York, this school became a haven for a headquarters of liberal thought, and Briggs was leading the charge in many ways, but there were several others there. And because of the criticism that they got from various Orthodox ministers, the school pulled out of its affiliation with the Presbyterian Church also and became independent. As you know, Harry Emerson Fosdick became perhaps the most well-known teacher there in the early 20th century, through much of the first half of the 20th century.
So if you go back, you're saying that over the last 100 years, and a little more, but especially over the last 100 years, these denominations have just accepted liberal theology, and I'm going to go ahead and use the word heresy, within their own clergy, within their seminaries, from their own pulpits. And you reach the point now where I can't imagine what would get one kicked out of these denominations on theological grounds.
Well, the one thing that would get you kicked out, perhaps, is the assertion that the only way to be saved is to repent and believe in Christ Jesus or something of this nature, though some of them would find a way to tolerate you there. The basic motivation for liberal theology, as they saw it, was to save the church, to save Christianity. They believed that the criticisms that were coming from science and from rationalist philosophy were going to render the churches irrelevant in their generation. And the only way to answer this was to accept the ground upon which rationalism and science stood and try to make a case for belief in God on that basis. And, of course, once you do that, you capitulate and you've given up the gospel itself.
I'm talking with Dr. Gregory Wills. He's professor of church history here at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, the author of several important books and other writings in church history. You know, this question fascinates me because it is counterintuitive that an organization would intentionally do what is not in its own best interest. And assuming that these churches intend to exist, and given the fact that they have huge bureaucracies, they better intend to exist. They intend somehow to perpetuate some membership. They have all these old towering buildings with their pipe organs, and they have institutions and all the rest. But they're just losing members by the millions. How bad has the loss of membership been in these denominations over the last half century?
Well, it's a lot worse than it looks on paper. And as you know, it looks very bad on paper. This 1994 study that you've referred to a number of times within the Presbyterian Church of America, the PCUSA, they indicated that only 33% of the Presbyterian members actually attended church regularly. And so
if their membership's been cut in half and only 30% are attending, that's bad enough. But the other thing that's not measured in a lot of these studies is how old these members are. Because in many cases, what you have in these mainline Protestant denominations, these very liberal churches, is that they're basically filled with people who are very elderly and just kind of hanging on because it's their church. They're going to be there until they die.
That's right. It's their church, and they were raised in a culture of loyalty and identification with their churches, and they will indeed hang on until they die.
All right. The opportunity for you to join the conversation is to call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. This particular program was really prompted by an email question I got from one of our listeners who, listening to much of our discussion on these things in terms of news stories, said, why are people there? And what are these churches thinking? Well, you know, if you've not been following this stuff for a long time, those are obvious questions. What in the world are these denominations thinking? Liberal theology is a series of rescue attempts for the church, for Christian theology. The assumption is that the worldview of the culture is now so dominant that the church is going to have to accommodate itself to that culture, to that worldview. It's going to have to surrender whatever truth claims are necessary in order to be found acceptable by a secular culture. Of course, the problem is when you're found acceptable by a secular culture, you're a secularized church. And when you reach that point, no one needs you. They can get better music somewhere else. They can get better services somewhere else. The phone number is 877-893-8255. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We're talking about what's going on in liberal Protestantism and why, and what difference it makes. My guest today is Dr. Greg Wills, professor of church history here at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. His specialization is American church history. Extremely well suited for this conversation. We want to invite you to join us by calling 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I want to do what's called a taxonomy here. We're going to do a taxonomy of American liberal Protestant life. I want us to go brand by brand and tell the story. And I think some of you will be interested to know kind of what happened to these denominations and how they found themselves in such a liberal position. The Episcopal Church USA has been so much in the news lately. How in the world did the Episcopalians get where they are today?
You may know that in 1873, you do know, the Reformed Episcopal Church of America was established as a number of bishops and lay leaders formed that movement out of protest of the liberalism they found within the church. And so this is not a new thing. This has been going on for a long time.
So what happened is, and the denomination we now know is this Episcopal Church USA, it was the liberals who didn't leave as far back as the late 19th century. Then they've been moving on. And they've had a history of heretical bishops, and I mean heretical in the classic sense, well into the in the early 20th century. And then by the time you get to the mid-20th century, you have someone like Bishop James Pike, who is basically an atheist, but he's still a bishop of the church.
Yes, and one of the sad things here is that so many believers remained in that church. And although this undoubtedly grieved their hearts, they were willing to tolerate this in one measure or another. They did not have the authority necessarily to take any action with regard to the bishops, but they certainly could have taken action with regard to their local church and their local giving and, if necessary, their membership.
Will Herberg, American historian and sociologist in the mid-century, pointed out that most of the, or at least the largest number of persons in government connected with one church were Episcopalians. The largest number of persons associated with both houses of Congress were in the Episcopal Church. It used to be the elite of WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant culture. Now it's so small, its numbers are less than not only Jews, but some would suggest less than Muslims in the United States.
It's an extraordinary fact. It's a tragic fact. But if we don't as believers stand upon the absolute truth of the scriptures, if we're not willing to take a stand for the gospel, then our churches are at risk and we become, in one measure or another, complicit in heresy.
Join the discussion by calling 877-893-8255 from Charlotte, North Carolina. Don's on the line, listening on XM170. Go ahead, Don.
I just had a quick question. I wanted to know, how much do you think that the willingness of the liberal mainline churches to accept heresies and not stand up for their principles has to do with the fact that less and less people are going into the ministry, and so they're afraid that if they don't let these people stay, even though they may be committing heresies, they'll run out of ministers.
You know, Don, an interesting point you make there. I want to split it up just a little bit here and to say part of it is trackable to the number of people responding to the ministry, and in particular, how few of them are actually headed for the pastorate. If you go to liberal seminaries, you'll be amazed by two things. Number one, that in many of them, women outnumber men, and there you have the feminization of the church. And in the second place, most of them aren't headed for the pastorate at all. You have several denominations very, very worried that they're not going to be able to have pastors for their churches. You have a return in some churches to more of a circuit riding kind of ministry where one pastor serves several churches. And the inevitable is that they're not going to be able to keep this going. Dr. Wills?
That's right. You see in many congregations now a consolidation taking place because there aren't enough of these ministers to go around. And one other marginal phenomenon is that some of these churches have to settle for evangelicals who are willing to serve there. I knew of a Unitarian church up in New England that actually had a Trinitarian for a pastor because they couldn't find a Unitarian.
Well, God has ironies interwoven into his history, of that is for certain. And when you start looking at what's happening in the northeast of the U.S., you do see some of this. You see evangelical pastors being called to these liberal churches because they're the only pastors available. When we come back, we'll continue our tour through mainline liberal Protestantism, talking about what happened in various denominations. Listen to it, understanding that the issue basic to all of these is the authority of the Bible. Once you abandon biblical authority, then you invite in not only some strange doctrines, you invite in all strange doctrines, and before you know it, the heretical doctrines quickly outplace and replace the orthodox theology on which the churches were established. We'll be back to talk about what this means. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. This is the Albert Mueller Program. My guest today is Dr. Gregory Wills, American church historian. I'm going to track this through real quickly because there are a lot of people who've been asking me questions, especially by email, saying, what's going on here? Let's track them down quickly. The Presbyterian Church USA, what happened?
Oh, my. Well, as you know, it's the formed by the reunion of the Southern and Northern Presbyterian churches, and the Northern Presbyterian Church capitulated to liberalism fairly early on, by 1900.
But the Southern Church was already pretty neo-Orthodox, too. It was in kind of a middle position.
Yeah, certainly by the 1920s, 1930s, liberalism had deeply infected the seminaries and was spreading rapidly among the pastors, so that the groundwork for that reunion in, what year was that, the early 80s, was already well underway, very early.
Now, we were talking in the news about the Episcopal Church, and it looks like there might be a new Anglican province, so another split off of the conservatives leaving. In the Presbyterian world, there have been several split offs in the conservative direction, but the two right now that a lot of people might be aware of would be the Presbyterian Church in America, the PCA, that came largely out of the Southern Church, although also some Northern congregations, and then the Evangelical Presbyterian Church, both of those more conservative, the PCA really clearly so. And, of course, the PCA is now one of the fastest-growing evangelical denominations, while mainline Presbyterianism is quickly crumbling in decline.
Right. One of the fascinating issues there is how some of the ethnic denominations, those that traditionally come from certain specific immigrant groups, have become havens for evangelicals because they preserved their denominational fidelity, in many cases their confessional fidelity.
United Methodism.
Oh, my goodness. Of course, once again, you have a reunion there of Northern and Southern, but early in the 20th century, you had a widespread commitment to liberalism on the part of the faculties of their divinity schools and seminaries.
A very naturalistic worldview that came through schools like Boston University, which was then a very influential, still is Methodist affiliated, but then a very influential Boston personalism, a philosophy that came in. And, you know, by the time you get to Methodism in the 1950s and the 1960s, there's a lot of liberal theology out there, but it's also in a denomination in which there are a lot of conservative congregations.
That's right. And to this day, many, many United Methodist congregations are evangelical, especially in the South. And here it's a great tragedy that schools like Vanderbilt and Emory, at a very early stage, were promoting a theology that their church members found reprehensible.
Okay, closer to home, the American Baptist Church, American Baptist Churches.
That's right, the American Baptist Churches of the United States of America, again, early, late 19th, early 20th century. Some of the leaders of American liberal thought came out of that movement. The University of Chicago was the headquarters of American liberalism, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I was there yesterday, and it still is, as far as I'm concerned. But let's also get to the fact that the church, the denomination that was then known as the Northern Baptist Convention, explicitly chose not to adopt a confession of faith that would in any way serve as a safeguard for their doctrine.
That's right. In the 1920s, when the conservatives made one of their two great efforts to recall that denomination to biblical fidelity, a very famous incident, Cornelius Wolfgang, a professor of New Testament, I believe at Rochester, stood up and said, really, the question is about whether we're going to follow the Bible and have no creed or whether we're going to follow a creed. And, of course, that's not the case at all. That was a red herring, no mistake. The issue for conservatives was, do our confessions reflect what the Bible actually teaches? If they do, then let us adopt confessions and hold our professors and our missionaries and our boards accountable to them. And by the way, many of your listeners may not know that the University of Chicago was begun as a great Baptist university and Baptist divinity school.
And the common tie between, say, Harry Emerson Fosdick, whom you mentioned earlier, kind of the paladin prince of American liberal theology. He was pastor of the Riverside Church in New York City, a church built by John D. Rockefeller, Jr., who also gave the money to establish the University of Chicago. Same man, same money, same theology.
That's right. And there was a great battle over John Rockefeller's money. A.H. Strong, who was president of Rochester Divinity School, Rochester Theological Seminary, he proposed the idea of the great Baptist University in New York and begged John A. Broadus, the president of this seminary, to come and be president so that Rockefeller would give the money and support a conservative school. The alternative was William Rainey Harper and a liberal University of Chicago.
And it's interesting to go back to that date and remember that American Protestantism was very unified in a more evangelical posture back then. For instance, Mr. Rockefeller also gave money to this institution, the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, established a building known as New York Hall, built with the Rockefeller brothers' money. So you look at that and you realize that that a lot of these fissures and divisions came soon after the 1920s, and yet some of them came even after that. Lutheranism, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, what went on in the Lutheran denomination?
Well, you have the same basic pattern there. One exception, though, is that you have this Missouri Synod Lutheranism, the Missouri Synod, which decided to take a stand against the growing liberalism and at Concordia Seminary decided to take it back. And one of the great courageous acts of any church in American history.
But you also have their mainline Protestant denomination. It is now called the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. And it came about because of a combination, again, of Northern and Southern Lutherans who came together, and it's very much now on the left. I would suggest that one of the reasons why you find some pockets of deep evangelical and traditional Lutheran theology is because Lutheranism has been a very ethnic movement in terms of a lot of German-speaking populations. And so there's a certain traditionalism that you find there, that at least an attachment to Luther and Luther's theology.
That's right, the Missouri Synod and the Wisconsin Synod, perhaps most prominently.
Okay, and then the Congregationalists. This may be the most tragic of all, because most people hearing me talk about this don't even know that they ever existed. That maybe they've already gone the way of the dodo. What happened to the Congregationalists?
Yes, and this is they're also tragic. But you know, the Congregationalists had a rich tradition coming out of New England Puritanism, out of the theology of the John Cottons and the Thomas Shepherds and the Thomas Hookers through Jonathan Edwards. And yet they were vulnerable to rationalism that crept in, starting in Boston, starting at Harvard College, and this made them vulnerable to accepting reason over revelation. And so many of those congregational churches became Unitarian by 1810, 1820.
And many of those that did not officially become Unitarian are now, or at least what's left of them, is called the United Church of Christ due to the merger of the Congregationalist churches and the old Evangelical and Reformed churches, another German-speaking Congregationalist denomination. And when you hear in the press or read in the press references to the United Church of Christ, you're likely to see them described as the most liberal of the major Protestant denominations, and they're working hard to live up to that name. But again, in every one of these denominations, there are conservative evangelical members found within them, and even some conservative evangelical congregations. The big question is, however, will these denominations even survive into the 21st century? Back with final thoughts in just a moment. This is the Albert Miller Program. Fritz is waiting on the line here in Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA for a question for Dr. Wills. Go ahead, Fritz.
Yes, I was wondering, if you look at the history of liberal churches, probably many of them never thought that they would go the way that they did. So when you look at the mistakes that were made, is there anything that we can learn as conservative denominations to prevent the infiltration of the liberalism that overtook them?
Well, I would say just two things, Fritz. First of all, I think every church member has a responsibility to maintain the fidelity of the gospel and the biblical witness in their own congregations and to do all that is in their power to keep their denominations faithful. And then when the time comes, to say thus far and no farther. And then the second thing is that we need to be very careful when we make the argument that we are going to stand on the ground of our culture in order to win our culture. When we do that, there is grave danger that we will capitulate the truth for the ostensible purpose of teaching truth. And in fact, we have lost the very standing ground for the gospel.
You know, that gets back to this this news story concerning Bishop Catherine Jefferts Shorey, the presiding bishop of ECUSA, the Episcopal Church USA. She acknowledged that the decisions made by her church are likely to lead to further membership losses. And yet she said, you never know, it might attract some persons on the other side. Now, that's a horrible missiology. It's a horrible misconstrual of truth and everything else. But just to try intellectually for a moment to bracket those questions, let me just ask you, is that going to work?
It will work only in the sense that the decline will continue and they'll be looking for other ways and they'll be initiating other studies and taking more money from the Lilly Foundation, other foundations to try to figure out how to preserve this sinking ship.
Several years ago, the Presbyterians did commission a massive project. They also commissioned three scholars to look at why all this is happening. They published a book. The report's entitled Vanishing Boundaries. And they came back to one essential finding, and that is when liberal churches move in a liberal direction in order to fit into the culture and the culture's expectations, they then do not stand out from the culture, and there's no reason to have them. In other words, the only reason to be a church is because you have something different to say than what the culture is saying. The only reason to be the church is because you hold to a different worldview than what the secular culture looks to and believes. And it's very easy in this conversation to, as evangelicals especially having this conversation, to look at the liberal Protestantism and say, we're pretty satisfied with where we are. Look at them lose all those members. If we are not careful, what happened here will happen there just later. And Fritz's question helps to remind us of that. Vigilance is called for, and the reminder that we have to maintain our theological integrity, or in the end, we'll lose it all. Members being just one of the losses. Back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. Thanks today to Dr. Greg Wills, my guest. I'll see you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.